Troubles with a Donkey in the Cevennes by Robert Louis Stevenson. Episode 5, A Night Among the Pines.
The wind fell during dinner, and the sky remained clear, so it was under better auspices that I loaded Modestine before the monastery gate. My Irish friend accompanied me so far on my way. As we came through the wood, there was Père Apollinaire hauling his barrow. He too quitted his labours to go with me for perhaps 100 yards, holding my hand between both of his in front of him. I parted from one and then from the other with unfeigned regret, but yet with the glee of the traveller who shakes off the dust of one stage before hurrying forth on another. Then Modestine and I mounted the course of the Allier, which led us back into Gévaudan towards its sources in the forest of Mercoeur. It was but an inconsiderable burn before we left its guidance. Thence, over a hill, our way lay through a naked plateau until we reached Chasserades at sundown. The company in the inn kitchen that night were all men employed in survey for one of the projected railroads. They were intelligent and conversable, and we decided the future of France over hot wine until the state of the clock frightened us to rest. There were 4 beds in the little upstairs room, and we slept 6. But I had a bed to myself, and persuaded them to leave the window open. "Eh, bourgeois, il est 5 heures," was the cry that wakened me in the morning. The room was full of a transparent darkness, which dimly showed me the other 3 beds and the 5 different nightcaps on the pillows. But out of the window the dawn was growing ruddy in a long belt over the hilltops, and day was about to flood the plateau. The hour was inspiriting, and there seemed a promise of calm weather which was perfectly fulfilled. I was soon under way with Modestine. I was now led by my good spirits into an adventure which I relate in the interest of future donkey drivers. Beyond the gully of Chazizac, the road zigzagged so widely on the hillside that I chose a shortcut by map and compass, and struck through the dwarf woods to catch the road again upon a higher level. It was my one serious conflict with Modestine. She would none of my shortcut. She turned in my face, she backed, she reared, she, whom I had hitherto imagined to be dumb, actually brayed with a loud hoarse flourish, like a cock crowing for the dawn. I plied the goad with one hand, with the other, so steep was the ascent, I had to hold on to the pack saddle. 6 times she was nearly over backwards on top of me. 6 times, from sheer weariness of spirit, I was nearly giving it up and leading her down again to follow the road. But I took the thing as a wager, and fought it through. From Blémar, after dinner, I set out to scale a portion of the Lozère. At the top of the woods, I struck leftward by a path among the pines, until I hit on a dell of green turf, where a streamlet made a spout over some stones to serve me for a water tap. The trees were not old, but they grew thickly round the glade. There was no outlook except northeastward upon distant hilltops, or straight upward to the sky, and my encampment felt secure and private like a room. By the time I had made my arrangements and fed Modestine, the day was already beginning to decline. I buckled myself to the knees into my sack and made a hearty meal, and as soon as the sun went down, I pulled my cap over my eyes and fell asleep. Night is a dead, monotonous period under a roof. But in the open world it passes lightly, with its stars and dews and perfumes, and the hours are marked by changes in the face of nature. What seems a kind of temporal death to people choked between walls and curtains is only a light and living slumber to the man who sleeps afield. And there is one stirring hour unknown to those who dwell in houses, when a wakeful influence goes abroad over the sleeping hemisphere, and all the outdoor world are on their feet. When that hour came to me among the pines, I wakened thirsty. My tin was standing by me half full of water. I emptied it at a draught, and feeling broad awake after this internal cold aspersion, sat upright to make a cigarette. The stars were clear, coloured and jewel-like, but not frosty. A faint silvery vapour stood for the Milky Way. All around me, the black fir points stood upright and stock still. By the whiteness of the pack saddle, I could see Modestine walking round and round at her tether. I could hear her steadily munching at the sward. But there was not another sound, save the quiet talk of the runnel over the stones. As if to be more like a peddler, I wear a silver ring. This I could see faintly shining as I raised or lowered the cigarette, and at each whiff the inside of my hand was illuminated and became for an instant the highest light in the landscape. And yet even while I was exulting in my solitude, I became aware of a strange lack. I wished a companion to lie near me in the starlight, silent and not moving, but ever within touch. For there is a fellowship more quiet than even solitude, and which, rightly understood, is solitude made perfect. And to live out of doors with the woman a man loves is of all lives the most complete and free. As I thus lay, between content and longing, a faint noise stole towards me through the pines. I thought at first it was the crowing of cocks or the barking of dogs at some very distant farm, but steadily and gradually it took articulate shape in my ears until I became aware that a passenger was going by upon the high road in the valley and singing loudly as he went. There was more of goodwill than grace in his performance, but he trawled with ample lungs, and the sound of his voice took hold upon the hillside and set the air shaking in the leafy glens. There is a romance about all who are abroad in the black hours, and with something of a thrill we try to guess their business. But here the romance was double. First, this glad passenger, lit internally with wine, who sent up his voice in music through the night, and then I, on the other hand, buckled into my sack, and smoking alone in the pine woods between 4,000 and 5,000 feet towards the stars. When I awoke again, I saw a faint haze of light upon the horizon. I lit my lantern, and by its glowworm light put on my boots and gaiters. Then I broke up some bread from Modestine, filled my can at the water tap, and lit my spirit lamp to boil myself some chocolate. While I was thus delaying, a gush of steady wind as long as a heavy sigh poured direct out of the quarter of the morning. It was cold, and set me sneezing. 10 minutes after, the sunlight spread at a gallop along the hillside, scattering shadows and sparkles, and the day had come completely. I hastened to prepare my pack and tackle the steep ascent that lay before me, but I had something on my mind. It was only a fancy, yet a fancy will sometimes be importunate. I had been most hospitably received and punctually served in my green caravanserai. The room was airy, the water excellent, to say nothing of the tapestries or the inimitable ceiling, nor yet of the view commanded from the windows. I felt I was in someone's debt for all this liberal entertainment, and so it pleased me, in a half-laughing way, to leave pieces of money on the turf as I went along, until I had left enough for my night's lodging. I trust they did not fall to some rich and churlish drover. The Lozère lies nearly east and west, cutting Gévaudan into two unequal parts. Behind was the upland northern country, through which my way had lain, peopled by a dull race, without wood, without much grandeur of hill form, and famous in the past for little besides wolves. But in front of me, half-veiled now in sunny haze, lay a new Gévaudan, rich, picturesque, illustrious for stirring events. Speaking largely, I was in the Cévennes at Monastier, and during all my journey. But there is a strict and local sense in which only this confused and shaggy country at my feet has any title to the name, and in this sense the peasantry employ the word. These are the Cévennes with an emphasis, the Cévennes of the Cévennes. In that indecipherable labyrinth of his, a war of bandits, a war of wild beasts, raged for 2 years between the Grand Monarch with all his troops and marshals on the one hand, and a few thousand Protestant mountaineers upon the other. 180 years ago, the Camisards held a station even on the Lozère where I stood. They had an organization, arsenals, a religious and military hierarchy. Their affairs were the discourse of every coffee house in London. England sent fleets in their support. Their leaders prophesied and murdered. With colours and with drums, and the singing of old French psalms, their bands sometimes affronted daylight, marched before walled cities and dispersed the generals of the king, and sometimes at night, or in masquerade, possessed themselves of strong castles and avenged treachery upon their allies and cruelty upon their foes. Strange generals, who moved apart to take counsel with the God of hosts, and fled or offered battle, set sentinels or slept in an unguarded camp, as the spirit whispered to their hearts. I should find it difficult to tell in what particulars Pont de Montvert, to which I descended, differed from Monastier, or Langogne, or even Blémard. But the difference existed, and spoke elegantly to the eyes. The place, with its houses, its lanes, its glaring riverbed, wore an indescribable air of the South. All was Sunday bustle in the streets and in the public house, as all had been Sabbath peace among the mountains. There must have been a score of us at dinner by noon, and after I had eaten and drunken and sat writing up my journal, I suppose as many more came dropping in one after another, or by twos and threes. In crossing the Lozère, I had not only come among new natural features, but moved into the territory of a different race. These people, as they hurriedly dispatched their viands in an intricate swordplay of knives, questioned and answered me with a degree of intelligence which excelled all I had met, except among the railway folk at Chasserades. They had open, telling faces, and were lively in both speech and manner. They not only entered thoroughly into the spirit of my little trip, but more than one declared, if he were rich enough, he would like to set forth on such another. Even physically there was a pleasant change. I had not seen a pretty woman since I left Monastier, and there but one. Now, of the three who sat down with me to dinner, one was certainly not beautiful. A poor, timid thing of 40, quite troubled at this roaring table d'hôte, whom I squired and helped to wine, and pledged and generally tried to encourage, with quite a contrary effect. But the other two, both married, were both more handsome than the average of women. And Clarisse. What shall I say of Clarisse? She waited the table with a heavy, placable nonchalance, like a performing cow. Her great grey eyes were steeped in amorous languor. Her features, although fleshy, were of an original and accurate design. Her mouth had a curl, her nostrils spoke of dainty pride. Her cheek fell into strange and interesting lines. It was a face capable of strong emotion, and with training, it offered the promise of delicate sentiment. Before I left, I assured Clarisse of my hearty admiration. She took it like milk, without embarrassment or wonder, merely looking at me steadily with her great eyes, and I own the result upon myself was some confusion. If Clarisse could read English, I should not dare to add that her figure was unworthy of her face. Hers was a case for stays, but that may perhaps grow better as she gets up in years.
Alan Cumming was reading the fifth episode of Travels with a Donkey in the Cevennes by Robert Louis Stevenson.